Saybrook did help me really figure out, like, where is my place that I can push back and try to achieve change and raise awareness. And so for me, that place is the Helms Amendment.
Hey everyone, Nathan Long here, president of Saybrook University in the great city of Pasadena, California. Welcome to another episode of Saybrook Insights. Today, I have the privilege of interviewing an alumnus of Saybrook University. Dr. Ellen Gatti has a PhD in psychology. She's a political activist and justice-oriented philanthropist. She works with IPAS, a global health organization that improves access to safe abortions and contraception in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And their other primary goal is to support efforts to repeal and/or reinterpret the Helms Amendment, which you're going to learn a little bit more of her personal connection to this effort. In addition, she's been one of Saybrook University's major donors, supporting the work currently being done in our Department of Transformative Social Change. There's some bonus material at the end here that I think you're all going to love, which is a little personal reveal on Dr. Gatti's part. Can't wait for you to hear it. All right, let's get to it with Saybrook alumna, Dr. Ellen Gatti. Dr. Ellen Gatti, it is so great to have you here on Saybrook Insights today. Would love to hear from you about your journey to Saybrook University, just a little bit about your personal life and how you found your way here.
That's not an easy, little answer, though. That is the thing. I have to start at the beginning. I grew up in a Southern right-wing Christian fundamentalist political family. My grandfather was the late United States Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina. His political platform was anti-abortion, anti-LGBTQ rights, anti-civil rights. He killed federal arts funding in the United States and was also in the 80s and 90s. Opposed to research funding for HIV/AIDS. And so this was kind of the political legacy that I was born into. And to say the very least, my upbringing was very interesting. I often joked, and I say joked, it was actually kind of true. My family was the traditional family values one-trick pony. We were always on the political stage, especially during campaign season, which was a whole lot of my childhood. And the good side, I spent a lot of time in DC growing up, so I was always kind of at the heart of the action of the political scene, and that was very cool. I also had my life threatened by the Panamanian dictator Emmanuel Noriega because my grandfather was in political terror in the region.
I can say I knew you when.
And I was so young. I was 5 or 6, but I remember sitting and looking outside at the yard and being who is this person and are they coming? But it was very real. And that was kind of scary, but that turned out okay. But I also, at one point when my grandfather was out of office, got to meet Bono with my grandfather and had backstage passes to the U2 show. And so there were definitely some very memorable, colorful, fantastic moments growing up in this. But alongside of those moments, there was always this very dark, very oppressive understanding that my grandfather's politics hurt people who did not look or believe like him. And I was fully enmeshed in that belief system while I was growing up and, like I said, was on the political platform reproducing that worldview as a child and adolescent. But on the back burner of my consciousness, there was always this this doesn't feel okay. And I would like to say that my rupture from that was something really amazing, but actually it was just going off to university. And my original major, I went to a big university here in North Carolina, and my original major was environmental geology. Oh, and it was a merger of business and geology. And what that meant for me was that I was on track to be an oil and natural gas lobbyist in DC. In fact, my very last trip to DC when my grandfather was still in office, I had lunch with a high up executive of Exxon, I believe. I think it was Exxon, in the Senate dining room. And so that path was like charted and it was like laid out in front of me. And Nathan, if I had taken that path, I would have become like the most horrible, terrifying version, like soulless version, like compromised version of myself. Like I can see who that person would have been and like probably would have embodied some of the mean-spirited like politics of my grandfather. And it was not okay. I'm so glad I didn't choose that path. And instead, while I was at university, you know, just studying geology and the sciences, I just kind of had this rupture from the worldview that I was born into. And I was like, okay, I don't believe any of this. Like, I just don't.
Stop there for a second.
Okay.
So the rupture came, and I appreciate that. So was there a seminal moment in that? Like, was it a class? Was it an interaction, a series of interactions? What would you equate led to that?
So I think like I always had the back burner consciousness stewing. So it wasn't like university like became that. So I always had that. I was always right there.
Okay.
But I feel like if I have to, it was definitely a geology course. And I think it was just one of the very interesting geology courses where it just like broke my worldview open in a way to be like, the world is so much bigger than like the worldview that I inherited. Like, it's just, you know, science will do that. It's like so expansive. And yeah. And so that completely like transformed my path. I only did 2 years of big university, and then I moved out west and I eloped.
Wow.
I know. And then I started kind of getting, we moved to the West Coast. So I started, you know, dabbling and enjoying some of the amenities of like Western culture, like yoga and superfoods and like liberal thinking and things that like I just did not have access to like growing up. You know, like back here, like kale was like a garnish, and like out there, kale was like, even 20 years ago, was like a luxury salad. You know, just tiny things like that that were so different that like, you know, continued this like opening and rupture for me while I figured out what I did in fact believe. But unfortunately, that party ended when the terrorist attacks of September 9/11 happened. And it's interesting to contextualize that because my grandfather's political career is actually the beginning and the end of his Senate career are the two 9/11s. The first was the Chilean 9/11 of 1973. And during that one, a democratically elected socialist president was couped and died and then overthrown. Government was taken over by the right-wing dictator Pinochet. And the human rights abuses that happened there are very well documented. And my grandfather went right in and became friends with Pinochet and like aligned with him. And so that was kind of like the beginning, the first 9/11. And then, of course, you know, the second 9/11, which was the attack on the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon here in the United States. And for those of us who, you know, were old enough and alive then, it was a devastating collective trauma. Like, I can still, like, go back to that day and see the images and, like, see where I was and feel where I was. And it was devastating for all of us. But for me, it had this like this extra layer of like visceral awfulness to it, because it felt like, if I can put words to this, like whatever my grandfather's intergenerational trauma that enabled him to like project out onto, you know, his involvement in political terror in Latin America over the course of a couple decades, it's like, there was like this historical full circle that happened. And it's like that intergenerational trauma came home to roost and like was kind of symbolized to me by 9/11. And I knew in that moment that like just moving out west and having a rupture it didn't mean that this political legacy that I inherited was going to go away. It was always going to be there until I did something about it. And if I didn't do anything about it, even though I was nowhere near to being a mother at that point, it was going to pass down through me. And so that when 9/11 became this moment where I had to make the decision about whether or not I was going to reconcile this legacy and how I was going to do it. And spoiler, I did. I decided to do it. And I knew that because it was so much more than my, like, required so much more than individual work, it also required like an understanding of politics and history and sociology and psychology. It was an intersection and merger of all these things. And so I landed on academia as, like, you know, the place where the container that would help facilitate like this process for me. And because I had left, you know, university back in North Carolina after 2 years, I had to first complete my undergrad. So I went to Antioch University in downtown Seattle. And so they have the, I don't know if they still do, but they had at the time the BA in liberal arts, and it was all for adult learners going back to school. And it, the pedagogy that guided it was transformative adult learning, which is about creating critical consciousness, which is a little bit different than critical thinking. It kind of includes that, but it's basically about how you take inventory and account for like your history that you've inherited and your politics and your family of origin and all these things that shape your identity that you might not have thought about. And then taking those things and placing them in these individual kind of things and placing them in the existing social matrix and kind of understanding where you are in history and where you are also like in terms of power and influence and like the social cultural hierarchy. And the point of all that is how you become an agent for social change in the world. And so I was really lucky. I had really supportive faculty, teachers, and mentors at Antioch. And I designed my program in psychology and social change there. And I took a ton of psych classes, a ton of sociology classes. And at the end of it, I realized I have just barely scratched the surface. Like, it kind of gave me the foundation that I needed to really start the process of reconciliation. And I knew that to do this work, it's not just like in here, you have to, it's like theory and praxis. You have to take it out into the world in the form of social change and like push back on some part of your lineage that you're not okay with to heal it. And so I had this fantastic mentor and counselor, and he's like, have you heard of Saybrook? Because I know you're interested in getting your master's and PhD and pursuing your work. So of course I like looked into Saybrook and I found that I could get a master's and PhD in psychology while concentrating in transformative social change. And of course I was like, okay, I'm in. So like I applied right away and enrolled, and the rest is history.
Wow. How long ago was that?
Oh my gosh. I started in 2008. And it's interesting. I started and my grandfather died like right after my first orientation, either my first orientation or my first like residency.
Okay.
So it was very interesting that I had started this and he passed at that.
Yeah, time. That tracks. My mom is pretty much aligned with your politics and your worldview. And I think I even recall when Senator Helms passed that my mom actually made a phone call to me about his passing because she had been involved in a lot of work, a lot of the early work that you're we'll get into, but that you're working on now. I got to put a pin on that for a minute. Well, I just need to go back to this Manuel Noriega thing, mm-hmm. just for my own morbid curiosity. What happened there? How did you have a thing put out on your life, a hit? Or
I remember he had either in his house or in his jail cell, he had like Helms hate or Helms death or kill Helms, some sort of poster about my grandfather, like up. And he just made threats because my grandfather was involved in all sorts of stuff down there, both in Central America and then, you know, with dictator Pinochet. And he upset the wrong person, and it was nothing was probably ever going to happen, but it was enough of a threat that like we were made aware of it and we knew about it. And I was told at five that it was an issue. And so I think it just kind of resolved. I have no idea. I have no idea.
That's pretty heavy. Oh my goodness.
It was pretty heavy. Like I said, for a 5-year-old, I'm like looking out the windows, like, is this person gonna come? And they never did. I'm here. We're all here. But yeah, it's scary. It was very scary.
You're part of the of this international intrigue at five. I mean, that had to be something. Oh my goodness. Yeah, no, that's very fascinating. And to have that the arc that you mentioned, especially, I really like how you framed that, the two 9/11s really kind of framing your grandfather, but also your kind of arrival to consciousness, you know, that it really played out. I've been so impressed and intrigued by your background, and I think, you know, especially around women's reproductive health, and you came to that understanding, I think it sounds like early on, especially with this rupture that you had at university. And again, I appreciate that you're saying that this was kind of brewing in the back of your head all those years. So I want to take a minute to dig into that, because I think so often, you know, the current conversation nationally is that students go to university and that these liberal professors indoctrinate everyone, and you got to think how I think. But I happen to have I don't know, maybe it's because this is my work and this is what we do. But we're really opening doors. We're not telling people what to think or how to think. And it sounds like, you know, for so many of our students at universities, there's already a lot of things milling around in your mind about what is this? How does this work? Why is this happening in this way? And if you're intellectually curious, you're going to probe and explore. And it sounded like you were questioning all of these things, all of these pieces earlier on. Can you describe that? Like, and you may not have an answer to this, it may, you know, but I'm curious, like, when did that initial consciousness start coming up? What were some of the questions that emerged for you, kind of around what age, and what developed before you went to college?
Like I said, it was it we were I was so enmeshed in the worldview, and it wasn't that it was just a belief system that like I had inherited. It's like we were actively culturally reproducing that belief system by being like on the political stage and in a political family. I mean, it was like a job, like that I didn't get paid for. It was like unpaid child labor. Anyway, totally. And so there was never, for me, it was like, other than this doesn't feel good. Like, you know, that in the background, there wasn't a lot. Although there is one story that's coming to my mind now that I should say. Okay. So one of the terrible things my grandfather did was, Harold Mosley Braun was the first African American United States Senator. Do you know the story?
I don't know the story, but I know her. I know of her, and she's pretty amazing.
And she was ambassador. I don't know her title right now. I apologize. And this is my apology to her, by the way. But apparently, so she was elected, and they wound up in an elevator, the Senate elevator together. And he either sung or whistled Dixie to her. And just like things like that were like, oh, does it feel good? And on one of my trips to DC, I wound up, and I was young, it was kind of not too far after it happened, enough that I had enough awareness to know that it was her, and I knew what had happened, and I was in the elevator with her, and it was awkward, and he didn't say anything, he didn't do anything. He didn't say anything, but he was kind of acting, you know, you could feel like it in his like posturing. And like it was moments like that that were like, this doesn't feel good. Like, this is not okay. And so that was a big one that I recall.
It really started to jiggle your consciousness and saying,
Yeah. And it was like little things like that all along the way, I'd say. I mean, but that was a big one. I mean, that was a very big one.
did he, you know, and maybe you can't answer this, but I'm curious, you know, I'm always struck, and I maybe kind of rising out of the political realm for a minute, but in this kind of, when people espouse a certain set of values related to, you know, and I'm not anti-religion, but I'm just saying religious values about treating one another as you would want to be treated, caring for, you know, your humanity. Did that ever come to him when he would do things like that to like Carol Moseley Braun and others, like the dissonance, the hypocrisy?
Yeah.
Did that ever arise? Or
no, because I don't think he never thought he was doing anything wrong. He thought he was just being funny. And that's a big part of the problem. He was not. That awareness was not there, that it was.
He did not have the self-conscious awareness that was necessary. Yeah.
Or if he did, he didn't care. I mean, so we could go either way with that. I mean, if we're honest. Yeah.
Were you ever able to confront him, or did you ever want to confront him?
I think the only thing I ever confronted him about was, it was about geology, which is hilarious. It's none of the big things, because like this full disclaimer, he, by the end of his final term, I mean, he was very far into dementia.
Okay.
And that was like when I was, you know, leaving the South and, you know, working on developing my critical consciousness and really thinking about that. But we did have one conversation when I still lived in the South. And I think he was saying that tar sands, like if you were going to drill for tar sands, that it had no environmental impact. And I was like, no, it actually does. And like a lot. And it's weird. And I attribute this to like where he was in the dementia, but he basically said, I didn't like him. Like, he's like, well, she didn't agree with me, so she doesn't like me.
And was he at any point cueing into the fact that you two were politically diverging?
I don't think, no, because he didn't have, because of his, you know, mental health at that time due to dementia, there was never that awareness. My grandmother did. He did not.
How did she take it in terms of that divergence?
I think it was hard because she knew that I had, you know, I was living out west, and she would make comments every now and again, like, you know, I don't see you anymore. And I don't know. But even though I would see her as much as I could when I came back, but she and I got into a conversation about Pinochet. And, you know, because I think I think she might have gone down with my grandfather to meet with him. And, you know, I told her, she said, no, the people were in the streets, like banging on pots and pans when like he came and took over. And I was like, well, yeah, but there were also these very well documented, horrible, atrocious human rights abuses that happened there, like political terror and torture. It was not pretty. And she was like, that's not what he told your grandfather. And she's like, that's not what happened. And why would he lie? And I'm like, I don't know. Why would he lie, Grandma? I mean, I can come up with so many reasons. But she was never going to change her beliefs around that, even in the face of like, you know, historical record.
It's interesting you bring him up. There was just an article a couple days ago, I believe, in the New York Times on Pablo Neruda and how Pinochet had actually, at least everything points to the fact that he had him murdered.
And a lot of other people.
3,000 at this point that we know of, right?
Yes.
And documented cases. So, you know, I can only imagine, and that is unfortunate that legacy in terms of connecting our government with Pinochet's in terms of the human rights abuses. It tracks, but it's unfortunate nonetheless. I mean, that we have that engagement.
It's really hard, but one thing like I noticed, so after, you know, the political terror, like when, you know, the right-wing authoritarian military governments were kind of taking over across Latin America, when those civil wars and the dirty wars kind of played out and ended, a lot of those military leaders who did horrible things to their people, like came and sought refuge here in the United States. But during Obama's administration, he was like, you got to go home now. And they were like, well, you at some point, like, you know, supported this down there. And now you're going to send us home. And like Obama doing that was saying, well, that wasn't on my watch. And democracy in the United States government is an evolving entity as well. And like, I didn't do that, and you're going to go home. And I think that's very powerful. It speaks to the fact that we are in a living, breathing political system that does evolve and does change and does go through a process of reconciliation.
Well, and your grandfather came from a period of time, right, when he rose into the Senate, of, you know, the U.S.'s stance was really kind of at its zenith in terms of anti-communist, anti-far-left, you know, efforts and really pushing any government that would thwart that. And, you know, certainly I think there's an argument to be made that communism in its extreme forms was very detrimental, but the quote-unquote cure was not necessarily what we know. It was damaging to millions along the way. So now let's fast forward. I know we've been kind of ping-ponging here. I'm just fascinated. Your story is just so cool. If you talk about, you know, you talked about the Saybrook, kind of coming to Saybrook, how you landed here, and then you emerged into this environment where you're studying with these pretty cool faculty members, very cool.
Very cool, yeah.
Yeah, I should say very cool. Very cool faculty members, but it's at a distance, largely with some residential experiences. What was that like for you? And did you have kids yet? What was the whole situation like there in terms of your experience as a student, as a, you know, wife and, you know, working adult and all those things?
Sure. So when I started in 2008, it was still Saybrook Graduate School and Research Center.
Back in the day.
And so I was there for all these like transformations of the university into what it is today. But back then it was still very much built on like the one-on-one individual mentor model with your professors, where every single class you were able to like structure it. You know, you had the theory and then you were able to structure it how you needed to fit into the work that you were doing. And so immediately I found Dr. Mark Pilisuk and Dr. Joel Fetterman. But with Mark, he had written a book called Who Benefits from Global War and Violence?
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of people, actually, and organizations and corporations. But the cool thing about that, I was like, who else was I going to? I mean, I couldn't have found a better mentor. I'm like, I'm reconciling political terror. And you wrote this book about who benefits from global war and violence. And so, of course, we were like this perfect match. Mark was like very much in the mentorship model. And so he just like, he took me under his wing and he's like, you're going to do this work and I'm going to support you while you do it. And Joel was the same way. And so I was very, very lucky that way that like I immediately found like my people. I had a really strong cohort. And also what helped was that Mark was working on a 3-volume peace anthology with Dr. Michael Nagler at Berkeley. And so all of us got to, like, I co-authored with Mark then, and we were all edited, like, all those pieces, and we were kind of involved in that process. And so we had this, like, this mission where we were all doing our own work, but we were also, you know, publishing and like, being able to work together on this really cool, you know, project. And so that really, really helped like anchor my master's program. And so I was like the latest arrival to that cohort. So everyone graduated before I did, but I had enough of that to like see me through. And so I would say that master's was a breeze, all things considered. Mark was my thesis chair. And then I would say that PhD coursework was okay too. And then I got pregnant, and I would say that was okay while I was pregnant because I got a ton of energy from like the baby hormones, and like my output was phenomenal, and I like plowed through all my candidacy essays except for like or half of them. And then I had my daughter, and she didn't sleep for a whole year, and like my health decline, and I was going batty because I couldn't sleep, and I had taken all the time off from Saybrook that I could, and I dropped back in with Mark, and I had like that last essay to do, and somewhere like amidst like the happy uplifting baby hormones, like I'd written like a 30-page essay that fit, and I don't know if I was trying, I don't even remember, Nathan, like I think I was using it to publish something. I wanted to submit it somewhere, but it worked for the essay, and I thought it was not good enough, and I thought I was done and like was out of time, and I would have to like drop out of Saybrook, and re-enroll, and I didn't know if I could. And so I gave it to Mark, and he's like, this is good enough, go. And it wasn't A plus, but it was A minus, and that was good enough. He's like, if this is the thing that will make you like leave, you know, higher education, he's like, no, this is good, like go. And then once I got through that, I was able to get through the pilot study or whatever it was. And so, yeah, I think whenever you're an adult learner, when you're married and you have families and work, and I was on boards at that time also, I think as a student, like coming to Saybrook, you have to know that everything that can go wrong is going to go wrong. Like when I was at graduation, that is what everybody said, you know, at our like college graduations, like everybody, like everything is going to break in the house. Like your relationships are going to suffer. You know, it takes so much of you. And if you don't to complete a master's and PhD, and if you don't know that going into it, and no one really knows how much it takes until you're in it. But if you don't expect that things are going to all blow up, then it's going to be really shocking and harder when you're in there. So you need to go into it knowing that things are going to like explode, and then they're going to like ground, and then it's going to be okay, and you can get through it.
Perfect. I was just having this conversation with students, new students coming in last night, and that was the zone of the conversation, is that it's doable, and it's very doable. But be prepared for the unexpected, right? And that's okay. That's part of the experience that you learn. So I appreciate that. So, you got to Saybrook, you've graduated, you've been out for several years now, and you've been doing some amazing work in the space of women's reproductive health, political consciousness raising. Could you speak a little bit? There's this little publication called Politico. And you wrote this article for them that came out not too long ago. And maybe speak about that and also your work in women's reproductive health, specifically about abortion and what's been going on in that world for you and what you've been doing. Yeah.
So I would say that, like, as part of like wrapping up my PhD program, like I kind of, you know, had the good sense to realize that I cannot reconcile all of my grandfather's political terror. You know, that it's not, I can't bite off all of this and like fix it all. I just can't. It's too much. There was too much. But Saybrook did help me really figure out like, where is my place that I can push back and try to achieve change and raise awareness. And so for me, that place is the Helms Amendment. And so you might be wondering what the Helms Amendment is. And it is a 50-year-old, it turns 50 this year in December. So it's a 50-year-old law that denies U.S. international aid from being used to perform abortions, even in cases of rape, incest, and threats to the mother's or girl's or pregnant person's life. Foreign funds cannot be used as a means of family planning. And unfortunately, the way that it was written by my grandfather was that these funds can't be used as a means of family planning, like for abortion, was like the way it was written. But it has been interpreted by every single presidential administration since 1973 and interpreted and applied as a total ban on abortions globally using U.S. funds. And to put that in perspective, so think about what's going on in Ukraine right now. We know that women and girls are being raped and surviving horrible sexual assaults by Russian soldiers. And of all the aid that we've sent over, billions, I forget, the 1.7 might be the latest aid package, like none of that can go to help these women end unwanted pregnancies because of Helms. And so when you look and see that the United States is like by far the largest funder of global health and family planning funding and globally, and you think of all those women and all those countries that are far away from here, do not have bodily autonomy and hence economic freedom because of Helms, and it's not okay. And so my the Politico piece was written to coincide the United States Senate, first the House a couple years ago, and then the United States Senate in July introduced a bill called Abortion is Healthcare Everywhere Act. And this would repeal the Helms Amendment entirely. And unfortunately, it's hindered by the filibuster. It requires like 60 votes. And so it really is right now just a very symbolic piece of, you know, a very symbolic bill to introduce. They know they weren't going to get the vote, but they're trying to raise awareness about the issue, especially now that Roe has fallen. And we'll go back to that. We'll table that. Go back to that in a minute, because Roe also should have turned 50 this year, last month, but did not. And so the Helms Amendment, you know, Roe was ruled, and it gave women in the United States, it legalized abortion nationally. And then at the end of the year, 50 years ago, my grandfather pushed back against that internationally with the Helms Amendment saying, well, we won't fund abortions overseas. And so I, so this summer I've worked behind the scenes with a global health group called IPAS for many, many years as a funder and a funder of abortions globally, but also working with them to figure out how I might be part of the solution to push back against Helms. And we came up with this idea of writing the op-ed and having that coincide with the introduction of the Abortion is Healthcare Everywhere Act in the Senate. And my letter was my op-ed was written as a letter to President Biden. It was, once it was edited, it was a little bit different because he started his Senate career the same year as my grandfather, and they worked together. You know, they had a very good working relationship, even though they believed completely different things. And I think both of them were proud that they were able to work with each other, even though they were so different. And I, you know, over the years had met then Senator Biden many times. He was actually the only Democratic senator who would come over and say hello to my family, because we were like on the same like swearing in circuit and time and all that. And so if my grandfather had taken us on the Senate floor, for example, he would come over. And that very last meeting when I was in D.C., when I met with had lunch with the oil executive, my grandfather was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Senator Biden then was the minority chair. And so I got to go into that room, and he was sitting there, and he saw me, and he called me over, and I got to sit in my grandfather's chair next to him. And, you know, just like have a brief conversation about, hey, how's it going? And, you know, but I remembered him. He was like someone that I remembered growing up as like, hi, you always made an effort to say hi to my family and be nice. And I don't remember really meeting any other Democratic senators. And so my letter was like, hey, we've met, and the Helms Amendment needs to go. And so it was just written as like, I appreciate like your influence on my grandfather, and I appreciate, you know, like the changes that you were able to bring about in him. And this is a really important issue. And even though we might not be able to repeal the Helms Amendment right now, President Biden could reinterpret it to say, hey, U.S. foreign funds can go to abortions and cases of rape and incest and threat to the mother's life. And so that would end the outright, you know, total ban on our funding for abortions going overseas. And so, yeah, so the Politico piece went out, and Helms is still stands, but we're IPAS and others, you know, it's a big year. There's going to be a big 50th anniversary push and media push to try to keep it, you know, on the mind of the public and say this is something we can do right now, because, you know, the world looks to us to determine like what they fund in their own countries. And so if we are backpedaling on abortion rights, they're like, well, why should we? And when the Helms Amendment came about, you know, 50 years ago, only a handful of countries, you know, had like abortion rights, you know, legal abortion rights already in place. But as we liberalized all these countries that were receiving our aid around the world did as well. And so now we have the situation where a whole bunch of them do have access to abortion legalized, and they can't even, you know, use our funds in accordance with their own laws because of Helms. And so it's like this overreach of our government.
Gotcha. So as you kind of think about the future of where women's reproductive health goes, right, and you think about what, you know, whether it's Saybrook students or, you know, not just Saybrook students, people around the country, given Roe v. Wade is now fallen and Dobbs is now, you know, kind of the quote unquote, I guess it's the law of the land, or it overturned Roe. And it's now the decisions are in the state legislatures and governor's mansions. What can people do from your perspective, you know, kind of in a nutshell? What do you think the next steps people need to do? I mean, you're already doing some of that work, which is great. So you're providing an example. But what are some other things that people can do from your perspective?
Well, that's a great question, because a lot of my work up until now has been focused globally. And here in North Carolina, we with restrictions, you know, abortion is still legal, but the pushback is coming every day. And we have all the women coming in and pregnant people coming in from southern states, from the north. Like we are having a lot of people come here to seek care. So I think, of course, you know, Saybrook students are international and all over the United States, and definitely reach out to your state, your congresspeople, and your House of Representatives and your state Senate and your governor, and do whatever you can to let them know that you care about this issue. And also, like, if you're in a state where abortion is legal, look at us over here. Look at states who are like North Carolina, who are having to take care of a lot of women from surrounding states, and, you know, donate to those groups. Like, do your research and donate to the groups who are providing care to these women, because they need it. And so that's an important thing you can do. And also, in terms of the Helms Amendment, you can reach out to your U.S. senators and the House of Representatives, and tell them to continue to care about the Helms Amendment and to continue to reintroduce the Abortion is Healthcare Everywhere Act. And I think it's just going to take that, even if it doesn't receive a vote, it's going to take that continuous reintroduction that just keeps it, you know, that's how the system works. It keeps the issue on the minds of politicians, and it lets them know that you care and that they need to keep pushing on this issue.
Well, and I think the bright spots are that even in some of the most conservative states like Kansas, you and I talked about this a few months ago, right? I think that, you know, in terms of bright spots for women's health and reproductive rights advocates, the people of Kansas said, whoa, wait a second, that's too far, right? I mean, we need to think about this in different, you know, like, this should be, you know, we don't want to go that far. There are opportunities, I think, for us who are interested in this topic to agitate for change, to also make sure that the laws that are being passed or being amendments being proposed can be agitated against. As president of a nonprofit, I am not advocating a particular political position.
I understand.
However, if you are interested, these are options, and that would be true of any political position.
Correct.
Yes, there you go.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that Republicans and Democrats both need abortions and both seek abortions. And what happened with the fall of Roe, it was a very calculated, very smart political effort, but it's also reflective of a minority rule. Research has shown that 9 out of 10 people in the United States support abortion access at some level.
Yeah.
And we have a Supreme Court that does not reflect like the law of the land on this issue, the way that we all believe, or that 9/10 of us believe. And so in a weird way, I kind of feel like culturally this battle has actually been won, but it doesn't mean we can stop fighting and that we have to keep pushing back, because I do think the majority of the population is for some access, abortion access at some level. And that's very powerful to remind ourselves, even as we're watching like our bodily autonomy and reproductive rights being stripped away here.
So fabulous that you're on the show today. And, you know, for those who are listening, this is our Transformative Social Change Program in action, right? So Dr. Gaddy is providing that real-life exemplar. Unfortunately, we have to draw to a conclusion today.
Bummer.
I know. I could talk to you for hours. Well, we're going to get a chance to in March.
Know,
I'm very excited. But before we close each show or interview, I ask my guests to provide their deep thoughts. Actually, it's very high-level thoughts. And my first question is, what does the term or word humanistic mean to you?
Okay, so I have to answer this question in terms of what does the term existential humanistic mean to me, because I was so deeply influenced by, like, the existential.
Always the Saybrookian. I love it.
Thank you, the crew. I was deeply motivated by the cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker, who looked at the denial of death and the birth and death of meaning, and basically in a nutshell said that the problem with us is that we're aware that we're going to die and that we create these belief systems to buffer existential anxiety and terror. And then when they abut and go up against other people's belief systems that are also buffering existential terror and anxiety, that, you know, that terrible things happen and we kill each other over our beliefs. And so I love his take on what does existential humanistic mean? Like, if you were to, you know, like, distill it down. And I've told somebody this before and they couldn't handle it and they didn't get it. So I hope you like this, Nathan, but
drum roll, here we go.
Are you ready? So Becker said that humans are gods, which I've added goddesses and non-binary deities to, that we're gods, goddesses, non-binary deities with assholes. And so we are capable of creation, and we are capable of destruction and doing terrible, terrible, horrible things to each other over, like, the nature of our beliefs. And that is the thing that we have to figure out if we're going to survive as a species. And so that's,
we have to grapple with that the true duality of the human experience, or the scope of that human experience. That's, you know, that may be the first time I've had Becker quoted in with that question and the use of the term assholes, you get an A+. So there you go. All right. Last question. And this is the big one. All right. You ready? What are three things you would recommend people do right now to improve their mental health, improve their physical well-being, or make great change in the world? It can be any of those things. Three things that come top of mind.
All right. First thing is, if you haven't already found, like, your, like, I found the Helms Amendment to push back on. If you haven't already found that thing that where your individual body and collective body and cultural body kind of, like, interface, that you need to reconcile and heal, figure out what that is and, like, find an organization that's doing the work and find some way to push back and implement social change, like, even if it's just volunteering or donating, and you can be small about it. It doesn't have to be anything big. You just have to keep with it and don't stop. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the salt cure, which I did not come up with this. I saw this on, like, a card in a coffee shop at the beach, but it stayed with me. And so the salt cure is that every day you need to either sweat through working out, you know, move, cry, which I've to that added also feel your feelings, cry and or feel your feelings, or soak in, like, a salt bath or the ocean. So every day, sweat, cry, feel your feelings, salt bath, ocean. I really like that. And then that, because it's hard to, you know, push back on, like, your Helms Amendment. So you need kind of that self-care.
Yeah, that's great.
And so then the final thing is that indulge in your guilty pleasure. As long as it's not illegal and it doesn't harm you. And I will say my guilty pleasure are, like, really raunchy romance novels, like, really raunchy. The raunchy.
No.
Yes. And it's the only way I got through my dissertation, because it was, like, so heavy in political terror and, like, the psychology of that and, like, my family lineage. It was so dark. So on one side, like, I had my computer here And on one side, I had all these textbooks and political terror books. And then over here, I had this stack of, at the time, I think I was reading like an adult vampire raunchy series. And like, it was this brood of like black leather vampires in like someplace random, like Pittsburgh. And it was like all of their romance, like how they were like, like finding their ladies and like softening in the world. And so I would like read political terror. And when I was crazy, I would put it down and I'm like, okay, let's see what's happening over here in like this vampire metaverse. And, just whatever your guilty pleasure is, that thing that like sustains you, like go for it. Just don't hurt yourself.
That's pretty awesome. We need an author recommendation. I need you to send that to me so we can.
I will. It's funny. The woman, the author, I can't remember her name, but I know she's actually lives in Charleston, South Carolina. But it was random that it was like Pittsburgh was like where these vampires were. But anyway.
Oh my goodness! All right, we're gonna have so much fun in San Francisco when we meet at the alumni gathering.
I can't wait,
Dr. Gatti. Thank you so much for being here today. Before we go, what are some websites, books, referral articles that you'd like to let our audience know about?
Definitely check out IPAS, IPAS. That's the Global Repro Justice Group that I've been working with. They're a fantastic place to start. They have so many like articles and research studies like already on their website. And so they're like my go-to resource.
All right. So you can find more about IPAS online. You can find more about Dr. Gatti online as well. We are so grateful to have you here today. We're going to have you back again and dig into this a little bit more about all of your work. Thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you, Nathan.
Ellen, thank you so, so much. What an amazing interview. Again, I could have just talked to you for hours. I hope you all enjoyed Ellen as much as I did. Remember her three major takeaways for today. Find that thing that you're passionate about to make change. Do the salt cure. So every day you need to sweat, cry, or soak in a salt bath. I'm going to do that tonight once I get home. And then indulge in a guilty pleasure. For Ellen, it's those raunchy vampire romance novels. But find yours and do it. For our video version of this and previous episodes, please visit our Saybrook YouTube page. It's pretty fabulous, and you can also find a lot more there related to our faculty, goings-on at the university, and the like. If you'd also like to support the Saybrook podcast, go to Apple iTunes and leave a 5-star rating and review and subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If you're on Spotify, leave that 5-star rating and make sure to follow us. You can, of course, subscribe to us on most major podcast platforms, including Google, Stitcher, Pandora, and many others. Remember to check our show notes for information on today's guests, including links to websites, books, and the like. And for more about our transformative social change program or the university, go to www.saybrook.edu, click on Areas of Study at the top of the page, and locate the program to learn more. Or simply Google Saybrook University Transformative Social Change Program. And a big shout out today. We have our producer, Phil Giangrande, who has just been doing amazing work over these many episodes that you've seen here in season 6. He has been recording this while also managing and working through a family situation. Phil, we are just so grateful for your dedication and our best to your family. You are a honorary Saybrookian through and through. All right, that's it, everybody. Thank you all. Take care. Be well.